KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Sarah McCammon. Coming up, families of some deported Venezuelans dispute the Trump administration's claims of gang affiliation and grapple with what comes next. Several of President Trump's recent firings of officials at independent agencies could upend a decades-old Supreme Court precedent. And later, Nadia Hussein tells us how to make the most of leftovers and everything that goes into them.
If you don't show your onions a little bit of love, you don't get the best out of them.
The great British baking show star on her new book, Cook Once, Eat Twice. And it's March Madness. We'll check in on the first round of the tournaments. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, March 22nd, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Israeli military says it struck multiple Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon after several rockets were fired toward Israel from the area. Hezbollah has denied any involvement. Lebanese health officials said at least two people were killed, including a child. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Sirens rang out in northern Israel early this morning after a relatively quiet few months. The Israeli military said three rockets were launched from Lebanon and all were intercepted. Israeli officials instructed the military to take, quote, powerful action in response, saying the Lebanese government bears responsibility for any rockets launched from its territory. Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam warned that renewed military activity with Israel could, quote, drag the country into a new devastating war. A fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has been in effect since late November. This is the first back and forth between the two since Israel broke the ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza. Both Hezbollah and Hamas are backed by Iran. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Heathrow Airport has announced it has reopened after a fire at a nearby electrical substation yesterday that closed Europe's busiest airport and caused global travel chaos. Villa Marx reports.
An airport spokesperson confirmed Heathrow was, quote, open and fully operational this morning, while airlines raced to get stranded passengers whose flights were diverted or cancelled through to their final destinations. The airport added hundreds of additional staff to help 10,000 additional passengers travel through Heathrow from around the world. But travellers are still being asked to check their flight status as several routes early Saturday had already been cancelled. The shutdown had initially prompted the counter-terrorism force at London's Metropolitan Police Force to conduct an investigation. However, suspicious causes for the fire have been ruled out, leaving UK lawmakers and ministers concerned about the resilience of Britain's critical infrastructure. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
Employees of Voice of America and various unions representing federal workers and journalists are suing the federal government over its attempt to shut down the broadcaster. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Since World War II, Voice of America, or VOA, has been broadcasting to foreign audiences, mostly in countries the U.S. considers repressive or authoritarian. It's had particular resonance in China, where for decades the broadcaster was seen as a reliable, uncensored source of news about China. But under the Trump administration and its federal cost-cutting drive, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees VOA, has taken it off air. The lawsuit filed in New York State Court this week says the agency overstepped and violated the First Amendment right to free speech in suspending VOA's operations. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, another broadcaster the agency oversees, has filed a separate, similar lawsuit. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News in Washington. An investigation is underway into a mass shooting at a park in Las Cruces, New Mexico last night. A city official says three people were killed and at least 16 people were wounded. The FBI and the state police are assisting local police. The Ethiopian army says it has killed more than 300 militia fighters in the northern Amhara region. Ethiopia is facing multiple ethnic conflicts that have killed thousands and displaced millions. Emmanuel Agunza reports.
Thousands of people are fleeing villages and towns in Ethiopia's northern region of Amhara following days of heavy fighting between the National Army and ethnic Amhara fighters. The Fano militia was a strong ally of the government during the two-year civil war that pitted the National Army against the Tigray People's Liberation Front. but they rebelled 2 years ago after refusing to disarm, claiming a violation of a peace agreement that ended the war. Ethiopia is struggling with multiple ethnic conflicts in the north, south, and west that have displaced millions. The country is teetering on the resumption of civil war and war with neighboring Eritrea. For NPR News, I'm Emmanuel Igunza in Nairobi, Kenya.
The foreign ministry in Denmark has changed its travel advisory for its transgender citizens, advising them they may have trouble entering the U.S. It said the application for a visa contains two gender designations, male or female, that applicants with an X designation, preferred by many non-binary people or those who have changed their gender, should contact the U.S. Embassy for guidance. President Trump had signed an executive order calling for the federal government to recognize only two genders. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Fiona Hill has an insider's perspective on President Trump's Russia policy. She served in his first term as the top Russia analyst. After resigning, Hill provided frank testimony before Congress during Trump's 2019 impeachment hearings, including this assessment.
The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance.
In just a few weeks of his second term, President Trump has upended U.S.-Russia policy and rattled NATO allies. For analysis, Fiona Hill joins us. She's now a senior fellow on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sarah.
The White House says that progress has been made to end the war in Ukraine, which was, of course, one of Trump's campaign promises. Do you think Putin wants a deal?
Well, Putin certainly does want a deal, but on his terms. So going back to the clip that you used from the testimony, the goal of Russia for economic, political, and, you know, frankly, territorial dominance in Ukraine remains. If we look back over that 6 years now since then, there's been really no change in the perception of Vladimir Putin that Russia needs to reassert itself. And it's just a question of how he was going to do that. But it's also very much related to an idea of pushing the United States out of Europe. And in that case, there is an overlap between what Vladimir Putin wants and what President Trump also seems to want. He himself seems to want to pull the United States out of Europe, not just pull U.S. support away for Ukraine and Ukraine's ability to basically push Russia back.
I mean, Trump has said that Ukrainian president, that Zelensky doesn't have the cards here. How precarious is Ukraine's position?
Well, it's very precarious when the United States has decided to forego supporting it. And, you know, really what President Trump is saying here, more to the Ukrainians, but obviously to the Russians as well, is he has a lot of leverage over Ukraine, but he frankly has little leverage over Russia. I mean, what we've seen in this last couple of weeks, and look, I mean, we have to give President Trump credit for trying to do something here, but it's pushed by his own sense of what is necessary here, rather than a full appreciation of what Putin wants and what Putin is after. President Trump keeps saying this war should never have started. Well, absolutely, but who started it? It was Vladimir Putin who decided on a full-on invasion against Ukraine that then turns into the largest land war in Europe since World War II. He then says this needless and mindless slaughter of people should stop. Well, again, Vladimir Putin doesn't seem to have had any qualms about the scale of losses on the Russian side, let alone on the Ukrainian side. So this is also part of the problem here, that President Trump is the person who's been driving the push for a ceasefire, a push to the end of the war, but he hasn't actually been approached by Russia in the first instance to actually mediate in this war.
When it comes to support for Ukraine, Europe, under pressure from Trump, has said it will step up financial and military support. Where do those efforts stand as you see them?
Well, look, Europe has already been financially and materially supporting Ukraine. And collectively, Europe and European countries, and then you add in Japan and South Korea, have exceeded the support to the United States, contrary to what President Trump has been saying. However, it is also very true that there is a huge reliance on US weapons systems. And that really comes down to the problem. The Europeans can, you know, pull together all kinds of funding. We've seen a lot of discussions about that. They can pull together some kind of expeditionary forces or other forces to assist if there is a ceasefire and, you know, some peace process. But ultimately, they can't in the short term replace the US weapons systems. And, you know, all of the actions that President Trump has taken as well have started to put the Europeans in a very different place as well. They're starting to see the United States playing a more adversarial role.
When you testified before Congress in 2019, you said that you do not think, quote, long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I wonder, do you still think that's the case? Do you think it is now inevitable?
Well, it's certainly not desirable, but I don't think it is inevitable. I think if you can restore deterrence, in other words, make it very clear to Russia that war doesn't work, that Putin is not going to achieve the goals that he set out by military means, then you can change the whole course of these relationships. However, again, restoring deterrence, you know, really means that Europe itself has to build up its own military capacity, which is, again, going to take some time. But it also means that the United States, you know, has to be very clear about what its position is right now from the European perspective, just to be very clear here, and I'm talking to European counterparts all the time, there's a real fear that the United States has switched sides. And that, in fact, you know, war that is being waged in Ukraine, which is also for the future of Europe and European security, is now going to be basically joined by the United States taking sides with Russia. Not obviously fighting against Europe, but certainly taking the positions that Russia has thus far taken in the war. I mean, again, I really, obviously, the conflict is not desirable. You know, I'm with President Trump on this. And I don't, again, think it's inevitable, but you're not going to actually head things off in the future and restore a stable situation if you basically capitulate to Russia.
That's Fiona Hill with the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for being with us.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Should President Trump have the power to remove anyone in the executive branch at will? The White House says yes, but for 90 years, the Supreme Court has maintained that there should be exceptions. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
President Trump's firings of the two Democrats on the Federal Trade Commission this week sparked fresh outrage.
I think the most important thing I can say is that this is corruption, plain and simple.
This is a sign that the guardrails are coming off.
Those were the fired commissioners, Alvaro Bedoya and Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, on a press call Tuesday night. The next day, the White House gave this explanation.
The time was right to let these people go, and the president absolutely has the authority to do it.
That's White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt.
The goal was to let these individuals go. If we have to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court, we certainly will.
The likelihood of that is high. Already, members of other independent agencies fired by Trump have sued, saying Trump can't fire them, that it's illegal because Congress created their agencies to have a degree of autonomy from the White House and to be bipartisan. In multiple cases, lower courts have agreed and returned them to their seats, but the Trump administration has appealed. This week, the appeals court in D.C. heard arguments in two of those cases.
Calling case number 25-5037 et al., Kathy A. Harris.
The central question now is whether a Supreme Court decision from 1935 should stand. It's known as Humphrey's Executor. Actually, it was about a firing at the Federal Trade Commission. It's come up a lot in court.
Most recent precedents And our principal guide on that question is the Supreme Court's decision.
90 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that FDR, who was president at the time, could not remove an FTC commissioner without cause. When Congress created the agency to protect consumers from unfair business practices, it said a commissioner could only be fired for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. But the Trump administration thinks that 1935 ruling should not apply to today's FTC or other agencies because of the power they now wield to make rules and issue decisions. The administration says agencies that serve the American people must be accountable to the president the people chose. That doesn't make sense to Jared Davidson of the nonpartisan legal advocacy group Protect Democracy. He says these agencies are supposed to be above politics.
What this president is doing is attempting to obliterate the design and intentions and goals of Congress in creating these agencies to be able to operate with a level of political insulation and independence.
And that's important, he says, because their work touches the lives of Americans in many ways. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigates discrimination at workplaces across the country. The National Labor Relations Board hears disputes between employers and workers who want better wages and working conditions. The Federal Trade Commission makes sure people and small businesses aren't harmed by corporate America.
Amazon, for example, we're suing for ripping off small business sellers on their site.
This is Alvaro Bedoya again, one of the fired FTC commissioners, speaking to Morning Edition. He's also looked into things like the price of insulin, the price of eggs, and of course, big tech.
Think about the billionaires who were over President Trump's shoulder at the inauguration. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos. I am currently suing or enforcing court orders against each of their companies.
Bedoya notes that the only seated commissioners left at the FTC are Republicans. His fear is that they will bend to pressure from Trump.
In a world where the president can fire anyone at any time, they have a choice. They can either obey, or if they say no, what will happen to them is what has just happened to me.
There are grave concerns about the president having that power, not just at the FTC, but elsewhere, like at the Federal Reserve. The country's central bank, which works to keep the economy stable, was similarly created by an act of Congress to be independent. Jared Davidson says if Humphrey's executor is overturned,
the president may very well view that as sort of carte blanche or an invitation to fire Fed members and order them to promulgate policy that is to his political benefit and not to the benefit of the American people.
Last fall, Fed Chair Jerome Powell, whom Trump appointed in 2018, was asked if he thought Trump could fire or demote him. His answer?
Not permitted under the law.
Not what?
Not permitted under the law.
Thank you.
Powell's term as chair runs until next year. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. A federal judge is deciding whether the Justice Department violated his order last Saturday. He had blocked plans to deport hundreds of migrants under an 18th century law that allows deportations in wartime without due process. The Trump administration had failed to turn around two planes with deportees after his ruling. In South Korea, hundreds of people have been forced from their homes by more than 20 wildfires being spread by strong winds. At least two firefighters were killed. And London's Heathrow Airport has reopened today after being shut down yesterday. A fire at a nearby substation had knocked out power to Europe's busiest airport. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Family members of migrants deported under a seldom-used wartime statute are pushing back against the Trump administration's claims that their loved ones were in a Venezuelan criminal gang. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran talked to some family members of those deported and brings us this story.
Sergio Andres.
¿Qué tal?
Juan Terán and I have been talking for more than a month now. That is because I've reported on his son, Carlos Daniel Terán, and how he was arrested by immigration agents days after President Trump started his second term. Carlos Daniel has been accused of being a member of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang recently designated by the Trump administration as a foreign terrorist group. Since then, Carlos Daniel has been detained at multiple immigration centers in Texas. But earlier this week, Terán, the dad, received a photo from his son's mother.
La mamá me acaba de pasar una foto. No sé quién le pasaría esta foto. Me parece que el hijo mío. Él es orejón.
He looks like my son, Terán says. He has big ears. I think it's him. But he's not completely sure. Yet it's the closest he's been to finding the truth since he stopped hearing from his son several days ago. Terán believes the photo confirms what he had feared. Carlos Daniel was one of the more than 200 immigrants sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, despite a federal judge's order to turn the flights around.
Yo sé que mi hijo es de mente débil.
I know my son is not that mentally strong, Terán says. He must be scared. He's never gone through anything like this. NPR talked to the families of four men believed to be in El Salvador. We found that none of them had a serious criminal record in the U.S. Only one had been charged with illegal entry. Three of the four had signed their voluntary deportation orders or papers. But the White House has not provided a list of names of the people on the three flights to El Salvador. They also have not provided evidence of crimes or gang membership. Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not reply to multiple questions about four of the men sent to El Salvador. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, was asked about this in an interview with News Nation on Wednesday.
Now, the information I had is every one of those Tren de Aragua, every one of those Venezuelans was a member of that gang. And that's who's on that flight.
But a source in the State Department says even within the department, the administration is not sharing any evidence that supports the claims that these men are Tren de Aragua. The source fears the men will never go to trial and will die in prison, given the harsh conditions in El Salvador's prisons and its track record on human rights. The source requested anonymity, fearing retribution, and because they are not authorized to speak publicly. This lack of transparency has left family members scrambling to find their loved ones. Mirelis Cacique says her family was able to identify her son, 24-year-old Francisco Javier Garcia. She says he was working as a barber in Longview, Texas, when immigration agents recently arrested him at his home.
El gobierno hablaba y decía que le iba a buscar a los peores criminales.
The government said they were going after the worst criminals, so we imagined it was going after murderers, Cacique says. NPR found no evidence Garcia has a criminal record in the U.S. Cacique says Garcia had signed his voluntary departure papers because he thought he'd be sent back home. On Saturday, he called his mom to tell her he was about to leave the detention facility in Texas. I'll be watching the planes. I know you will be on one of them, Cacique told her son. God bless you. But the flights landed in El Salvador. Now she's mad at the Trump administration and herself.
Entonces siento que fuimos ingenuos, confiamos en una gente que no respeta los derechos humanos.
We were very naive, she says. We believed the U.S. was going to respect his human rights. Now, Cacique says she prays for her son's return to Venezuela. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Cedar Park, Texas.
Americans have become more polarized about vaccines in the 5 years since the COVID-19 pandemic began. NPR's Jude Jaffe Block reports on the challenge this poses to combating public health threats.
When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, there was a moment when some people thought it could be a unifying time for the country, like 9/11 had been. But Matt Mata remembers when he felt convinced the pandemic would divide Americans instead. It was late March 2020, almost exactly 5 years ago.
Many states and municipalities had shut down. People were stuck at home, right, stay-at-home orders. And Trump promised that he was going to reopen the economy, have people back at work, leaving their houses again by Easter Sunday, 2020.
President Donald Trump was speaking on Fox News on March 24th, 2020.
So I think Easter Sunday, and you'll have packed churches all over our country, I think it would be a beautiful time.
Mata says those statements were at odds with public health experts at the time. He studies public attitudes towards science at Boston University's School of Public Health.
It's the efforts that President Trump made to portray COVID-19 as not being that serious that led to polarization.
Trump made false claims about the virus and pushed remedies that didn't work. Mata traces a direct line from Trump's comments 5 years ago to public opinion trends that persist to this day.
Why would you vaccinate if the infectious disease threat isn't all that serious? That's when we started to see a split in public opinion, such that Republicans came to hold more negative views toward vaccinating and Democrats came to hold more positive views.
There's a bigger trend. Americans with negative views toward COVID-19 vaccines are increasingly negative about other vaccines, too. 1 in 4 Republican parents are now skipping or delaying some childhood vaccines for their kids, according to a study from KFF, a nonprofit health policy organization. There are, of course, many factors that got us to this moment. University of Washington's Carl Bergstrom, who studies the spread of infectious diseases and misinformation, calls the pandemic
a big opportunity for people pushing anti-vax propaganda to get their foot in the door with new segments of the population, and they did that quite successfully.
One of the most prominent spreaders of that kind of propaganda was Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's now Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services. A very real consequence of declining vaccination rates is the growing number of measles cases in Texas and New Mexico.
There's very real concern that this could result in widespread outbreak of measles.
Dan Salmon directs the Institute for Vaccine Safety at Johns Hopkins University.
I mean, I really hope that doesn't happen, but the U.S. is quite vulnerable right now.
There's irony to the partisan divide on vaccines. The COVID vaccines were developed quickly thanks to Trump administration initiatives such as Operation Warp Speed. Carl Bergstrom again.
The COVID vaccine saved millions of lives. It was remarkably successful. It was developed in a tiny fraction of the time of any previous vaccine.
A success that would be harder to replicate in our current political environment. Public health experts are worried we aren't learning the right lessons from COVID-19, especially with concerns about a potential bird flu pandemic. Recently, the Trump administration slashed funding for research on vaccine hesitancy. And scientists fear research on the same mRNA technology, which was used in the leading COVID vaccines, could be next. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has halted deliveries to food banks in several states. Those truckloads of food were paid for with $500 million that had been set aside through an emergency assistance program for fiscal year 2025. This comes after the Agriculture Department cut $1 billion from a program that helped schools and food banks purchase food from local farms. These cuts come at a tough time for social service organizations across the country, many of which are dealing with state funding cuts and, of course, higher food prices. Jory Novotny is Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, and she joins us now from Columbus. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jory, what were you told, first of all, about the cancellation of these food deliveries?
Our food banks receive a few different sources of emergency food assistance. We have entitlement foods that are appropriated through traditional farm bill procedures and appropriations. And those are the foods that we can most reliably count on to consistently come into our docks. And then we often receive product through bonus or Section 32 purchases, which are designed to help the USDA support markets that are maybe in surplus or have a little bit of difficulty selling or buying. And then we have an opportunity to thankfully bring in additional product through the Commodity Credit Corporation. And those are the orders that we had, that we were expecting to see coming in, that we've received some changes in order status on. So we don't know if those TFAP orders, the Emergency Food Assistance Program or TFAP orders, have been permanently canceled or if they are merely halted. What we do know is without that food in the near term, we are going to struggle to meet our current demand.
How did you become aware of this change? I mean, how did this come across your radar?
So we're generally getting regular updates from our state agency and our federal partners about what foods are in the queue, if you will. So we'll see those status changes go from on order to scheduled for delivery to delivered. We look to try to have some predictability about what products we can count on from our partners at USDA so that we can then look for other food sources to supplement those foods. And we noticed that there were many orders that were on order under TFAP Commodity Credit Corporation that changed to being returned to AMS, the Agricultural Marketing Service arm of the United States Department of Agriculture. They're not listed as canceled, and we hope that what that means is basically the new administration is taking stock of what their priorities will be for clearing and supporting markets and supporting farmers and food banks.
So I understand there's a lot of uncertainty about what this all means, but right now, how much food are you missing?
For us in Ohio, I've talked to several food banks that have seen several loads of food that have come off of what we can expect to come into our warehouses. Going back to 2018, we've seen both of the previous administrations continue to invest in programs like TFAP that have connected farmers and food banks. That's led to really roughly $1 billion or so in food purchases annually. You know, I remain confident that this administration will continue on that path. Right now, we are uncertain about what that path looks like.
Give me a sense of how big the demand is. I mean, how many people is the Ohio Association of Food Banks serving right now?
Yeah, from July through December of last year, we fulfilled more food pantry visits in that six-month period than in any six-month period in our nearly 35-year history. What that tells me is that working families who were able to get by, even living paycheck to paycheck, have seen years of rising costs, yes, for food and also for other basic needs like housing, utilities, and medical care. And they're finding that they have a shortfall in their food budgets.
What do you hear from the people you serve when you have to make these kinds of cuts?
I think it's frustrating for everyone. I think, you know, we have 12 multi-county food banks that have large warehouses of food that they're bringing in and out, and then they're supplying that food to 3,600 different local hunger relief providers. And they're all wondering, why is there less food available at my food bank? And we did a survey about a year ago of 2,300 food pantry visitors. About two-thirds of the households that we're serving reported that the adults in their households skipped meals in the last year, and more than a third of them reported doing so almost every month or every month.
Jory, what happens if this continues? Do you see food pantries in Ohio or other parts of the country having to shut down?
Well, food banks receive roughly across the country about 20 to 25% of all of the food that they provide from USDA foods. If we don't have especially these wholesome center of the plate foods that we're fortunate enough to get through the Emergency Food Assistance Program, we're concerned about that. And I think we're concerned ultimately about not having certainty.
That's Jory Novotny, Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Jory, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
NPR reached out to the USDA for comment following this interview, but we have not received a response. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Guitar sharks, mud dragons, water bears, and, sorry, arachnophobes, sea spiders. Those are just a few of the new species recently discovered by a global research initiative called Ocean Census, which aims to learn more about all the mysterious life forms that live in the depths of our oceans. Lucy Woodall is the head of science at Ocean Census, and she joins us now from Oxford in the UK. Lucy Woodall, thanks for being with us.
Oh, great to talk to you today.
So you found just a ton of new discoveries, over 850 new creatures, I gather. Were you expecting to find so many?
Yes, is the short answer. We have such a wealth of diversity in the ocean, but we have knowledge about just a teeny tiny percentage of those, almost like just about 10%. So we knew there was going to be lots out there, but really delighted about how the global community has come together and worked to get this amazing number in just a few short years.
Right. I understand this involves a lot of cooperation between researchers from around the world. I mean, how does it work? How do you work together?
So, I mean, our job really at Ocean Census is to facilitate the amazing work that taxonomists do across the globe. And this can be things like doing expeditions together, but also to be able to share that knowledge, which is really important with early career researchers, that next generation.
Yeah, tell us about some of these new species you've discovered. I mean, they do have some interesting names like the guitar shark and the pipe horse. What are you finding?
Yeah, so the guitar shark that was found at about 200 meters depth, and that's about 650 feet off of the coast of Mozambique and Tanzania by an amazing shark expert based in South Africa. And this is pretty cool to think that something that's iconic as a shark, we're still finding these new species. But I'm really glad that you mentioned that pipe horse. It is one of my favorites. I've done a lot of studies on seahorses in the past, and they're part of the same family. The pipe horse is a little pipe with a sort of a turned up tail, and it's prehensile tail, and you sort of can grab onto things. They're so cute.
We know that the deep ocean often provides the potential for undiscovered life, but I gather some of these discoveries were actually made closer to home around coral reefs, for example. I mean, how is it possible that there are still undiscovered species in shallower waters?
I think the challenge we have is that our ocean data are biased and they're really patchy. We've only got tiny snippets, and the ocean is changing so quickly. So we really need to accelerate our discoveries. And that's what we're finding, not only in our deeper waters, where we haven't been able to explore so much in the past, but even in our shallow waters, where people even go on their holidays, we're finding new things. And I think this is partly because we've only got a few taxonomists and a massive ocean to try and look at.
Now, I've also read that many of the species you're looking for actually become extinct before they can even be documented. I mean, do you feel like you're in a race against time in a way?
Yeah, I mean, it really is that race against time. What we do know is that we know very little. The majority of our data have been collected from historically privileged areas. So now we need to open that up. So that not only do we have a really good understanding of the North Atlantic, which is where a lot of these data have been collected from, but indeed across the entirety of the world.
That's Lucy Woodall, the head of science at Ocean Census. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Bye, and thanks so much for speaking with me.
This is NPR News.
In Bob the Drag Queen's new novel, Harriet Tubman comes back to life and wants to use hip-hop to promote her cause.
If you're a theater nerd, if you're a black queer, if you're a history buff, If you like hip-hop music, if you like absurd concepts, this book could be for you.
Our conversation, plus the latest political developments, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israeli artillery and airstrikes hit South Lebanon today after Israel said it had intercepted rockets fired across the border from Lebanon. Hezbollah has denied it was responsible for that attack. Officials in Niger say heavily armed gunmen attacked a mosque in the western part of the country yesterday. At least 44 civilians were killed. They blame the attack on an Islamic State affiliate. And boxer George Foreman has died. He was 76. He began his boxing career as an Olympic gold medalist and became the champ by beating Joe Frazier in 1973. A year later, he lost to Muhammad Ali, but 20 years after that, at 45, he became the oldest man to win the championship. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. The Hong Kong company selling ports in the Panama Canal to a group of investors led by the U.S. hedge fund BlackRock is drawing criticism. The deal was hailed by President Trump as part of his administration's efforts to reclaim the Panama Canal, but the governments of Beijing and Hong Kong are not happy. Reporter Charisse Pham has more.
It was supposed to be a win-win for C.K. Hutchison, a huge and, as financial news network CNBC described it, fascinating deal that caught the industry by surprise.
Getting some breaking news on BlackRock today. For that, we'll turn to Leslie Picker. Hey, Leslie.
Hey, Carl. Yeah, this is some fascinating news crossing just moments ago that BlackRock is agreeing to purchase Panama Canal ports and over 40 additional ports. This is from C.K. Hutchison Holdings.
The company selling its global ports business for a hefty price tag while also getting itself out of a geopolitical spat brewing over ports it owned in the Panama Canal. But now the legendary Hong Kong group has found itself in the crosshairs of Beijing, even though in the U.S. it was seen as a conduit for Chinese influence abroad. Over the past few days, Hong Kong government websites reposted two scathing commentaries published by a Beijing-backed newspaper. One accused C.K. Hutchison of, quote, groveling and profit-seeking and selling out all Chinese people. The other appeared to take aim at billionaire Li Ka-shing, C.K. Hutchison's 96-year-old founder and Hong Kong's richest man. Titled, Great Entrepreneurs Are All Patriots, the commentary questioned whether C.K. Hutchison's ports deal is, quote, aiding and abetting evil and harming China and the world. Hong Kong's chief executive John Lee went a step further, suggesting Hong Kong businesses are being discriminated against.
We oppose the abusive use of coercion or bullying tactics in international economic and trade relations.
A C.K. Hutchison spokesperson has previously said the deal is purely commercial in nature and unrelated to geopolitics concerning the Panama ports. But now the company is in the middle of a domestic political storm. Faced with the recent barrage of attacks, C.K. Hutchison canceled a regularly scheduled press conference on Thursday around their annual earnings report. And this week, its share price was down by more than 6%. For NPR News, I'm Charisse Pham in Hong Kong.
Tomorrow is the perfect time to visit a sugar shack. It's Maine Maple Sunday, when syrup producers in the state open their doors and invite people to see, taste, and learn about the craft of turning maple sap into sugar. You can learn all about this tradition later today on All Things Considered. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. And now it's time for sports. It's March Madness. How are your brackets looking? The first weekend of the NCAA women's and men's tournaments is here. Also here, Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you. First, let's take a moment to remember George Foreman, who has died at 76. He was, of course, a two-time heavyweight world champion. That boxing fame led to a pitchman fame with his smiling face on the boxes of millions of George Foreman grills. I cooked with a lot of those in my 20s, as I recall. How are you going to remember him, Howard?
It's a big loss, obviously. I think you remember George Foreman, for me at least, is a man of real reinvention. And remember, he fought one of the greatest fights of all time against Muhammad Ali and Zaire in the Rumble in the Jungle in 1974, and came into that fight expecting to destroy Ali. This was expected to be the end of Ali. In fact, it was the beginning of Ali's rebirth, winning the championship after losing it to the federal government in 1967. And it launched Ali's career, his second career, and then sent George Foreman into a deep depression. And he was a villain back then. He was somebody who was really considered somebody who had lost more than just the championship. And then he came back. He came back and suddenly became two things. He became a champion at 45 years old, which had never happened. And then he also became a sort of Ali-type fun figure with the George Foreman grills. And he had a personality, and people loved him. And the villain of the late 60s, early 70s was all gone. And a really wonderful American story, and he'll be missed.
On to college basketball, and let's start with the women. South Carolina is the defending champion and a number one seed, although not necessarily a clear favorite. UCLA is the number one ranked team, but there's also USC, and don't sleep on the UConn Huskies. Who has the best shot?
That's a good question. Well, for me, the way I always do this is, if you're the champion, you're the champion until somebody knocks you out. And so South Carolina starts out by winning by 60 yesterday. And so I'm still going to go with Dawn Staley and her group. But UCLA has been the best team this year, and they beat South Carolina. And UConn beat South Carolina. And you've got Juju Watkins over in USC. And so there are a bunch of good teams out there. I think what I'm looking for, I think it would be kind of fun. You could get a USC South Carolina championship, but I think what I'd like to see, but be kind of fun, is a UCLA USC Final Four. Could be great to watch too. A lot of good teams out there. No Angel Reese and no Caitlin Clark this year, but you still have Paige Beckers out there, and you still got Juju out there. A lot of good players.
And in the men's tournament, the UConn Huskies are the two-time defending champions, although maybe not as strong this year. They're just an 8 seed. They defeated Oklahoma 67-59, moving on to the next round. How are they looking to you?
They survived yesterday. Then they suddenly came back and won. I mean, they have not. I mean, their coach, Dan Hurley, it's been a weird year for them. They're a two-time defending champion. He was going to go coach the Lakers, a job that went to J.J. Redick instead, after I think he turned down the Lakers and wanted to go for the three-peat. And a lot of his antics this year have sort of overshadowed the team. But they came back and beat Oklahoma yesterday. And they're playing arguably the best team in the country next in Florida. So it can be a very short trip for UConn, but if they get through Florida, then suddenly, once again, you're the champion until somebody knocks you out. On the other hand, the real story of the college men's side is Cooper Flagg and Duke. Everyone had been waiting for Cooper Flagg to come in. The expectation is he's only going to be here once because he's going to go to the NBA immediately following this. Duke is a terrific team as well. And so you look at them, and I sort of feel like Duke, Florida is what it's all about, but don't forget Houston's a very good team, and Auburn as well. I don't trust Auburn, although people will get mad at me for that because I think they're a little erratic, but I think it's Duke and Florida.
That's Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Great British Baking Show, or Bake Off as it's known across the pond, has featured many contestants who've become fan favorites for surviving bread week and battling pies prone to soggy bottoms. But perhaps none is more beloved than the mom of three who wowed judges with her triple-tiered lemon drizzle wedding cake, 2015 winner Nadia Hussein.
I am never ever going to put boundaries on myself ever again. I'm never going to say I can't do it. I'm never going to say maybe. I'm never going to say I don't think I can. I can, and I will.
And she has. Ever since then, Nadia Hussein has become a culinary star in the decades since, with multiple TV shows and cookbooks. And she joins me now from the UK to talk about her latest book, Cook Once, Eat Twice, Time-Saving Recipes to Help You Get Ahead in the Kitchen. Welcome, Nadia.
Thank you so much for having me. What an introduction.
You know, one of the things I love about this cookbook is that it really seems to be all about simplicity and efficiency. You know, it's divided into these sections with names like Back to Basics and Loving Your Leftovers. But I went straight for the chapter called Two Dishes because, like you, I am a mom. I'm busy. I just love the idea of getting more mileage out of a round of cooking. So what inspired this approach to cooking?
Essentially, all it is I'm making a huge batch of something and then I'm splitting it into two and then turning it into something else. So it doesn't feel like you're having the same meal twice. So you've got something like a beef stroganoff, which I'll turn into a stroganoff pie, or a bolognese that I'll turn into a chili, or a carrot soup that I'll turn into a carrot and cod curry. One of my kids' favorite is the corn chowder that I turn into little individual pies that we take to the park. So yeah, there's so many ways of being inventive and creative with one dish.
Just so you know, last night I just wanted to try this out, and before I went to bed I made the chicken curry. Okay, so the first step for this one is to heat up the oil and add garlic, ginger paste, and then eventually onions and salt. So we'll start with the oil. The onions are starting to boil. They're not quite golden yet. Might need a little bit longer. I'm a big fan of curries. I loved this one. I have one question though. So the onions, it says to wait till they're a golden brown. And for me, like, they just kept cooking and they got really soft, but they didn't turn brown. And I have to confess, I quit before they turned brown. I didn't quit the recipe, but I moved on. What did I miss there?
Sometimes you just have to crank the heat up and get it really caramelized, because everything has a little bit of sugar in it and it needs like a high heat, and get them to color quickly and then turn it down. And that's when they'll start to brown. But well done for persevering. The thing is with onions, with any good curry, the onion is the start. But if you don't show your onions a little bit of love, you don't get the best out of them. And I always give myself a good 15, 20 minutes to really cook down the onions. And when you've done that, you have the start of a really good dish.
So that was the first step, the curry. You set that aside and make the second dish, the orzo. I made the chicken curry last night. I've got half of it put away in a storage container, putting that in the refrigerator. And then this is part two. So this is a whole separate meal. So it says, start by putting half the curry in a pan, adding the orzo and cooking over high heat until the orzo is combined. Okay. How does this typically play out for you? Do you make it one night, feed it to your kids, put it in the refrigerator, come back?
Yeah, so what I tend to do is make the chicken curry, see how much of it they eat. And normally with a dish like this, they would normally eat half of that in one night, and then I'm usually left with the other half. That's why I've kind of increased the volume of the curry. Once it's cooled down, I might pop it in the freezer and make the chicken and orzo another night. That's why I kind of bulk the recipes up so you can get two dishes out of them.
That's what I was going to ask. You can freeze it.
Yes, absolutely. There's very few things that you can't freeze. I love my freezer. It's one of the best ways to save money, to save time, to save ingredients. I save everything down to my potato peelings. When I peel any root vegetables, whether that's parsnips, carrots, potatoes, swede, I will pop the peelings into a freezer bag, put it in the freezer, and then take it out and make a huge soup with the peelings afterwards.
You're really serious about not wasting food, and you have a whole section devoted to just that idea. I mean, you're doing really interesting things, even making a curry out of banana peels. Tell me more about where that sense of frugality comes from for you.
I think it definitely comes from growing up in an immigrant household. We did not waste anything. You know, I grew up with my grandma. She spent a lot of time with us. She essentially raised us when my parents weren't able to be around. So they had very little, and the little that they did have, they never, ever wasted anything, whether that was ingredients, whether that was old clothes. They would cut them up and turn them into blankets. And I always found that so intriguing. And it's something that I thought I'd never picked up until I had my own family and realized actually what I'd watched had been somehow by osmosis ingrained into me. And I just took to it. Like, I love the challenge of asking myself, is there any way I can use that? I make prawn oil, which is delicious when you're making noodles as a condiment on top. I never chuck away my garlic peelings because you just pop them in the oven, roast those, and then grind them down with some salt, and you've got instant garlic salt. There's so many ways of saving and not wasting.
The one in that section that really caught my eye is the chickpea meringue. I love garbanzo beans, chickpeas, use them all the time. I never thought to do anything with the water.
Yeah, so it's aquafaba, and when you pour that liquid out, it looks very much like egg whites, and there's some magic that happens when you whip that up and add a bit of sugar and you have vegan meringues. I have a little tub of meringues that I make every time I drain a can of beans. No matter what kind of beans they are, I always make little meringues because I just can't throw them away. I just think, what a waste of a brilliant, magical product.
You know, we're speaking during Ramadan, the Muslim holy month, and I know you have another cookbook that's devoted to that. That book is called Ruza. Is there one recipe that you particularly cherish this time of year? Maybe something you like to break the fast with?
Well, we always break our fast with cold water and a date. But the one thing that we have to have on our table every year is samosas. Every culture has its own version of a pastry filled with delicious things. Often they're filled with like spiced lamb or spicy potato and peas or chicken, tuna. There's so many variations. And my kids absolutely love them. And I make them by the hundreds.
Okay, let's end on a sweet note. Your father ran a restaurant. I want to know more about this ice cream recipe that I gather he used to serve.
What they used to sell is kulfi, which is an Indian ice cream that's made with thick cream, lots of ground whole spices, and it's made with bread. So it's got a lovely kind of just delicious Moorish texture when it's frozen. My dad would buy these prepackaged kulfis, and I was like, no, I've got to make my own version. So I kind of mastered my own version. It's so much better than the prepackaged stuff, but I think anything that you make from scratch is always going to be better than anything you buy from a shop.
Nadia Hussain's new cookbook is Cook Once, Eat Twice. Well, Nadia, it's been so nice talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Next week, Scott Simon will be back once again to say, BJ Lederman writes our theme music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.